It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a new report says women are still severely underrepresented in media, from sports anchors to film directors.
And on our regular segment on Food Friday, we challenge some common wisdom about which wine to drink with fish.
But first, the Women's Media Center just issued the results of a study that shows that women are still largely underrepresented in media.
Kelly McBride is with us now to talk about the study. She's a senior faculty for ethics at the Poynter Institute and co-editor of the New Ethics of Journalism. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So according to the 2014 Status of Women in the U.S. Media Report just issued by the Women's Media Center, women are still grossly underrepresented in media. Can you give us an overall picture of what the study found?
Well, sure. The study found that particularly in management and in sports journalism, that women are horribly underrepresented. And interestingly enough, they come out of the colleges at a much higher rate than men. And that's true for almost all undergraduate degrees. But in journalism and communications, it's particularly true. They enter the profession at higher rates than men, and then they trail off as they go through the ranks.
So does that seem to indicate that maybe the reason that men are so much more prevalent in media is that these are older people, that they've been in the jobs longer, and that the women just haven't moved up yet?
No, this has been going on too long for that to be the case. Women surpassed men as the bulk of J school graduates too long ago, more than a generation ago. So it can't be that. This is a leadership problem in media.
What do you mean by a leadership problem?
So there's a lot of different reasons why women leave the profession, we haven't spent a lot of time in media companies trying to figure out what those are and trying to figure out how we could change that. And this is true of other professions as well. I mean, tech companies have similar problems, although they don't have the same pipeline of women coming into the profession that journalism does. So I guess they're maybe less culpable, but there's lots of reasons that women don't succeed. There seems to be a bias placed on male writers over female writers. I mean, look at some of the pinnacle publications that we have, like The New Yorker or Wired magazine. You see male bylines at a much greater rate than you see female bylines. Why is that? Well, we don't actually know the answer to that question. But there are all these benchmarks of success in media where women just underperform, and we don't know if it's because they're not getting the opportunity, because the way we judge them is unfair. We don't value the female contribution as much as the male contribution. So it's complicated.
It's interesting that it seems to be so true across the board, from the directors of films, the huge proportion of which are men directors, to a statistic like over a 3-month period, 82% of film reviews are written by men as well. Why is it so true, you know, just uniformly in general?
Right. I mean, book reviews are the same way. And if you look at the people who run newsrooms in the country, it's the same thing. Why is that so uniform? Because men are controlling the decisions about who gets to do those things, and it's not a priority for them to diversify. So they're choosing, you know, like if you are picking people to do film reviews, you're picking them based on the criteria that you have, and you're likely a man. So the criteria that you grew up with is going to reflect your own biases. And until you deliberately get out of that mindset, it becomes this self-reinforcing cycle.
Do the findings seem to show that women are losing ground or that they're just treading water, holding steady?
You know, it really depends on how you slice it. But to the extent that, I mean, when you compare the number of people who graduate from journalism school or communications degrees, that number is becoming increasingly more female. So to the extent that that is that is failing to represent in leadership positions in media, you could say that women are losing ground.
I want to look at one especially low point, and this is the field of sports journalism, with the vast majority of reporters and anchors still white and still male. And given the increasing numbers of women athletes and women fans, why this number here? Why hasn't this changed?
I mean, this is particularly complicated because the world of sports journalism has exploded in terms of the people who are working in it. However, the audience in sports journalism, depending how you slice it, is predominantly male, particularly the audience that brings in a lot of revenue. So ESPN's audience is predominantly male, and when you look at how many hours people spend, not only is it more male, but men spend more time with ESPN products than women do. So that also tends to influence how they create their content and how they do their hiring. A lot of people in the sports journalism world are so hyper aware of this because they are topping out in their audience and they need to build new audience. Where's that audience going to come from? It's obviously going to come from the female population and the non-English speaking population. So the people who run sports companies, sports media companies, are super aware of this and they're trying to figure it out. But even then, they have this constant argument about, are women fans different? Do women fans just like good sports, or do they like female sports? And that's a legitimate conversation to have, and one that if you pick the first answer that women fans are the same and they just like good sports, you're still going to give them male sports because professional sports are predominantly male in our country. The WNBA is really the only successful professional female sports league. Has a fraction of the audience that the NBA has, and certainly a fraction of the revenue that the NBA has. The NFL and the Major League Baseball don't even have a female equivalent. So in those cases, the revenue and the money is still wrapped up in the male-dominated sports and the male-dominated audience. So it almost makes more sense that the sports world would be this way because that the sports media world would be this way because the sports world is this way. It makes less sense that that the rest of the media world would be this way.
Well, another troubling aspect of this report is the fact that the percentage of women of color in newspaper and magazine newsrooms has dropped overall. The fact that minorities continue to comprise only 12 to 13% of the newsroom staff. So what's going on there?
Well, in most newsrooms, the size of the staff has declined. Newsrooms have hit hard economic times over the last 5 years and have shrunk, some of them by up to 50%. And people of color have disproportionately taken that hit. Part of it is because people of color had overall less experience. The gains that had been made for people of color in newsrooms were relatively recent. And part of it is because newsrooms have less bandwidth to focus on the recruiting and the promotion and the training that you need to keep people of color. So if they can get another job at more money, they're going to do that because they're not getting the encouragement to stay on the jobs that they have.
So what are the effects of gender discrimination and unlevel playing field like this in the media? What does it do to the coverage that the world gets?
Well, ultimately, it affects the content. Because if you don't have diversity in the staff that creates the content, they're not going to think of the ideas. They're not going to contact the sources. You know, there have been other studies that show that the number of sources quoted in front page articles in the New York Times are predominantly male. Well, that's obviously related to the people who are creating the content. So it has these far-reaching effects. We don't discuss issues that might be important to people who are not white men. You don't see professional experts who are not white men quoted in stories. So it really plays out in this ripple effect to significant consequence to the entire society.
Kelly, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
You're welcome.
That was Kelly McBride, a senior faculty for ethics at the Poynter Institute. She's also co-editor of the recently released book called The New Ethics of Journalism.
Up next is Food Friday, where we'll bust some old taboos about fish and wine pairings. But first, Kristen Durst joins us from the newsroom with a look at these headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. It's time for Food Friday, and this week we're challenging common wisdom about which wines go best with fish. Most people assume fish goes best with white wine, but this week we put that assumption to the test.
Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies, is here to talk about her experiment serving fish with red and white wine to see which pairing came out on top. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, so how did you first get this into your head that you wanted to challenge this assumption that red wine is what goes best with fish?
This was a couple of weeks ago during restaurant week in Madison, where we found ourselves with three entrees, elk, squash risotto, and then lobster with a garlic oil and green sauce. And we wanted just one bottle of wine for the table, and I wasn't sure we could find a red wine that would work with lobster, and we did. It was a lighter red from the upper part of Italy. And while I've had some really good red wine with fish dishes, that got me really thinking, okay, I know there's a reason why we mostly do white. The oil in fish can sometimes react very strongly with stronger red wines, especially tannic reds. It can sometimes taste like iron. But we're changing so much the way we cook with fish. We're using bigger, more robust fish, and we're using definitely more robust sauces. So I thought this was time to actually sit down and really do some serious taste testing as to what works.
And going back to why white wine has been the staple when it comes to consuming wine with fish, is that really, I mean, were people really thinking about the chemistry of it, or is it more about taste?
A lot of it, I think, has to do with where fish tends to fit in with, say, a big dinner. A lot of time up until, say, 20, 30 years ago, if you had fish, it was an early course in the meal, and you'd have, you know, maybe a chicken or a steak or something to come afterwards. So you didn't do very much to the fish. And it would have been a lighter fish, so you would have had a lighter wine with it, just because you wouldn't want to get completely overstuffed and soused before your big entree came up.
Well, Lori, you, as our food guest, you always go above and beyond the call of duty. Oh. And this time you really went way out there, and you set up a spectacular tasting menu for the Central Time team, and you paired four different cuts of fish, types of fish, and different wines. And I wonder if you could kind of talk us through that. Where did you start?
We started our tasting with a simple pan-seared fish. I tried it before with grouper. What I served the Central Time team was tilapia. But we served it two ways. Compound butter, which is, in this case, lemon, parsley, and capers, something that gets served fairly often. And also a red pepper pan sauce, something really simple that you throw into the pan after the fish has been seared to deglaze the pan and use the fish juices and pepper and a little bit of vinegar to make a really good sauce. And I thought it was interesting that the first time I tried this, we had different reactions around my table, and then to get the entire team together, very different reactions as to what worked better. We had two whites. One was a little sweeter than the other, and we had a lighter Pinot Noir, a California red. And, well, tell me what you thought.
I remember thinking that the taste had a lot to do with how the fish was dressed, in a way, you know,
yes,
like what surrounded it. And with that one, you know, by the end of the night, I have to say, I don't remember much. There was a lot of wine, but I do remember thinking that
in most cases, both wines work just fine.
Which is something that made me feel absolutely delighted. The idea that there is no wrong answer here. A lot of people will avoid fish because, oh, I only drink red wine. I only like red wine. Well, we discovered throughout the course of our tasting that night that there are times and there are preparations where the red wine does seem to work better. That pepper pan sauce, I thought, worked beautifully with a red wine, whether it was tilapia or grouper. Now, I had some people tell me that it really needed the sweeter white, like a French Vouvray. And I had somebody at our tasting tell me that tilapia was just too mild a fish. If you were going to do a pepper pan sauce, you needed something that had a little more oomph to it. So right there, you've got, you know, same preparation, but just the change in fish could change what wine you were drinking.
Well, you also had tilapia. You poached it in some lentils, and I remember that being really delicious. Why did you think that would work with red wine?
Because I love lentils with red wine. Lentils are one of my favorite things to cook in the winter. It's a wonderful, homey, earthy dish. And I was thinking, okay, we've got lentils, and I've done successful dishes with red wine. If we were to add lentils and fish together, that's going to lighten the texture a little bit, but it may not lighten the taste. You've still got the layers of flavor with lentils, and then add the fish to it. And I had a feeling that that would be a good match for a lighter red. I thought so. What'd you guys think?
I agree with you. And I remember thinking I wouldn't have even thought to put lentils in with fish. So leave it to Lori to be experimental and innovative.
I got that recipe from an old issue of Gourmet magazine from an article called Impress Your Guests. And I think that was one of the things to surprise people with. Yeah, who would think about putting lentils and fish together? But it worked really, really well.
Oh, I need that cookbook.
And, you know,
so it's good to impress.
We also tried salmon with a soy maple glaze. Mm-hmm. And historically, I haven't cared for salmon much because to me, it's too fishy.
I'm the same way. Yeah.
And but you had us try it. I don't remember liking it. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Now, salmon is a fish that I think for a lot of people is where they can really start experimenting with how is it served. One of the first times I ever had a salmon dish that I can still remember, and this was over 20 years ago, but it was served with currants, apricots, and almonds in a kind of a rice pilaf with cinnamon.
Wow.
I never would have thought of fish and cinnamon, but that was, I mean it, 20 years later, I can still remember how good that tasted. And I know I had that with a lighter French red, and it was amazing.
Well, I can give higher praise for it than Cynthia's. Don't remember not liking it. I thought it was delicious, and I'm also a hard sell when it comes to salmon. I don't think I have any kind of palate whatsoever when it comes to wine, but I remember everything we tried tasting delicious together with that fish.
Oh, good. Good. I think most of us that night actually preferred the sweeter white wine with that. But again, if you're playing around, maybe serving a heftier side dish, you might want to think about a red.
There was one dish I remember where I thought the white wine definitely is a better compliment, and it might have been that one. One of the most exciting moments of the evening was the chance to try paella.
Paella, which I'd never heard of, but apparently, I mean, it's shown up as an ingredient on Iron Chef, and Anthony Bourdain loves it. This is a fish that you find in the Amazon, and it had been overfished, and it's now only available commercially because the Amazon is low oxygen water. This is a fish that can breathe water. It can grow up to 6 feet in length. It basically is all one tail. It's muscle. It's a big, sturdy fish, but the flesh tastes sweet. Now, I wanted something that we could blacken for this tasting. And when I was asking the fishmonger, okay, I've already got salmon. What do you have that I should blacken? He said, paella. And I said, what red wine would you pair with it? And he said, Cabernet Sauvignon. And I said something that I can't repeat on air. I didn't think a Cabernet, a big, hefty, eat with a steak Cabernet with fish. Are you crazy? And it was gorgeous. Absolutely amazing.
I left before that one, but I think that was the
crown
jewel. Yeah.
We served this with a Chilean red, which had a lot of herbs to it, but I actually went back the next day, got another filet, blackened it, and served it with a California cab, and it was just as good.
Lots of memories and lots of delicious things to try, and I think people will be trying different things now. Lori, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it and for cooking for Central Time.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
Lori Skelton is with us as part of Food Friday regularly here on this program. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster. Rob Ferret is back on Monday.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear from a reporter who's covering the Olympic Games at Sochi. She'll tell us about some of the stunning games that have taken place so far and what we can expect from the gold medal game this weekend.
First, many of us are familiar with the idea of emotional intelligence. Our next guest says that in order to become our best selves, we should build on that idea and develop personal intelligence to understand our own personality and the personalities of the people around us.
And by better understanding our own personal intelligence, we can do a better job weighing the choices we have in relationships, work, and family life.
We're joined now by John Mayer. He's a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire, and his new book is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
People are most likely going to recognize you from your work developing this idea of emotional intelligence. Can you talk about how that led you to create a theory that focuses more on a person's personality?
Sure. The two concepts, in a way, evolved together. But one intersection was that in 1990, when my colleague Peter Salovey, who is now president of Yale University, and I introduced our theory of emotional intelligence, I started wondering whether there was also a broader way of problem solving people had about one another. And actually, in 1995, there was a popularization, a journalistic account of our research, and a lot of people interpreted emotional intelligence to involve a lot of broader thinking about personality. But we had, in our original formulation, we thought and still think today, that emotional intelligence concerns reasoning about how we're feeling, about our emotions, whether we're happy or sad, and knowing how anger might turn into shame, and or vice versa, and the like. Personal intelligence is a broadening of that concept.
And let's get into personal intelligence. You say it's a broadening of the concept. How would you define it for us?
Well, most generally, personal intelligence involves the ability to reason about personality and to use information about personality to understand and reason and to improve our lives. And by personality, I'm talking really about the overall organization of our mental lives. So not only emotions, but our motives, our plans, our thoughts, our self-control, and the way we express ourselves to one another.
There are four areas of this theory. Why don't you walk us through them, starting with identifying information about personality?
Right. So one of the first questions that I worked with was, what kinds of problem solving might make up, what areas do we need to problem solve in to really understand who we are and who other people are? Because we all have personalities, whether it's our own or someone else's. And the first area is identifying clues to personality, identifying personality-relevant information. And so, for example, we might walk into somebody's home and see how it's decorated, and from that information, we might draw some conclusions, some preliminary ideas about what that person is like. If it's fabulously, beautifully decorated and designed, we might think that the person's a bit artistic, or we might wonder if they hired a designer, both start with both hypotheses. And then as we get to know the person more, we might look at how they're dressed, for example, over several days, and that might tell us something about how nicely they take care of themselves, how they like to look in public, and the like. And so we're always looking for those clues about people as we're encountering them.
And what about different models of personality? Does it actually help us to kind of put people into categories? In general, it seems like today we try to steer away from that and assume people are on a level playing field, but does it help if we put people into categories?
Well, I think it depends what kind of categories we're talking about. If they're accurate categories, or useful and informative categories, that can work well for us. And I mean nobody likes to be categorized. Let me start there. And we also may feel a little bit ashamed if we're categorizing people, but we really do have to do that to some extent. For example, if I'm looking in a driveway, if I'm driving into a driveway and there's a four-year-old in the driveway, I'm going to categorize that four-year-old as a four-year-old, and I'm going to be a lot more careful driving into that driveway than if there's a 30-year-old person standing at the side of the driveway. And those sorts of quick categorizations are really important to how we make initial judgments about people.
And talk about guiding personal choices with inner awareness. What does that mean?
What that means is that as we're, you mentioned categorizing people, but the second area of reasoning is really creating accurate models of ourselves and of other people. And although it can involve some categorization, it can also involve really creating a tailor-made or a custom-made picture of what somebody is like. And we do this for ourselves as well as for other people. So guiding choices, which is the third area of personal intelligence, involves drawing on the kind of custom-made or tailor-made picture we have about ourselves, and then using that to make decisions about what might work for us in terms of doing things like choosing a job, deciding whether to get married, deciding whether to have children, or many lesser decisions of lesser consequence, like which restaurant we might prefer to go to or what game we might enjoy playing more than another.
Now, is your theory of personal intelligence something that we are born with, or is it something that we can improve upon as we improve our self-knowledge?
It's definitely something that we can improve on by learning about personality. There's no research. I mean, the concept is very new. Plainly, the idea that we should know ourselves or the concept of reading other people is an ancient idea. It dates back to many ancient worlds and ancient Greece and ancient China and the Middle East and so forth. But what we've been able to, the place that we've been able to get to is, I think there's been a tipping point in the field of personality research over the past 30 years where the logic and the activity that people carry out to self-understand and to understand others, we're now able to specify that so clearly that we can build psychological tests that measure the ability to do that. So, for example, one of the tests that we've developed, and I'm coming back to the genetics, I haven't gotten there yet, but one of the tests we've developed, we ask people a question like, a woman is likes to be around people more than she likes to be alone, and she's also talkative. Is she more likely to be A, anxiety prone and insecure, or B, lively and energetic? And we know now that the answer is B, and people who give that answer know a little bit more about personality than other people. That is, a talkative woman who prefers to be with other people is pretty likely to be lively and energetic. Now, where this comes into the genetics question is that in order to determine the degree to which there's some heritability here, we have to really be able to measure the concept, and we're just starting to do that now.
So how does it help us to know that that woman is likely to be lively and energetic?
Well, it helps us to anticipate her future activities and to anticipate what she might be good at and to anticipate how much we would like to be with her, for example. We might like lively and energetic people, in which case we might want to spend more time with her, or we might be overwhelmed by lively and energetic people and prefer to be with people who are a little bit calmer and lower in energy. So that might be a starting or an entry point in considering, you know, do we want to be friends with that person, or can we be friends with that person? Do we have enough energy to be friends with that person or not?
You point out that for a long time, psychologists thought that personality didn't matter, which is kind of hard to believe when you consider how our personality drives the way we think and what we do. Why did psychologists cast it aside for such a long time?
Yes, this was something that was very shocking to me when I first started studying psychology, was this belief that, well, gee, personality doesn't really matter. And the reason psychologists thought that was that they had conducted, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were some really massive studies conducted of students in schools that discovered that the students, at least at first glance, were not very consistent in their behavior. And in particular, if they cheated on a test or peeked at answers when they shouldn't, there was very little consistency as to when they would do that and when they wouldn't. And so the researchers who conducted these studies, who were very influential, they were from Yale and Columbia universities, and they had enormous levels of funding, concluded that personality really might not exist, that character might not exist. And this really set a long shadow on the field of psychology and personality psychology for much of the 20th century. It was only really until beginning in the 1980s and 1990s that we came to grips with the what was accurate and what was inaccurate about that.
We're talking right now with psychologist John Mayer about the power of personality, and we'd like to hear from you too. How do you see personality shaping the world around you, and what questions do you have? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll keep going with this conversation in just a moment, but right now a few headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
A woman who tweeted, "I am dying," after she was shot in the neck by a sniper's bullet yesterday in Kiev, is recovering in the hospital today. Photo of the woman clutching her bleeding neck and being led away from the scene went viral as social media users around the world presumed she had died. Today she tweeted her thanks to those who supported her. The government can't seem to make up its mind about whether people should be allowed to make cell phone calls on passengers' planes. Even as one federal agency considers allowing the calls, another now wants to make sure that doesn't happen. Department of Transportation signaled in a 22-page notice posted online today that it wants to retain a ban on in-flight calls. About 4,700 Wisconsin Electric customers were without power at noon today as high winds continued to cause problems throughout the state. Xcel Energy had almost 2,550 customers out in the northwest part of the state. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst.
Tune in to Wisconsin Public Television Tuesday night at 8 for Frontline, Secrets of the Vatican. When Pope Benedict resigned, he left behind a bitterly divided Vatican mired in scandals. Can Pope Francis lift the Church out of crisis? Go inside the Vatican for an account of Benedict's final days and Pope Francis's battle to set the Church on a new path. Frontline, Secrets of the Vatican, Tuesday night at 8, only on Wisconsin Public Television.
Support also comes from the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership, bringing their 36th annual statewide convention back to Stevens Point April 24th through 26th, with hands-on workshops, national experts, and ideas for protecting our legacy of lakes. More at wisconsinlakes.org. Support also comes from the Alvarado Real Estate Group, a family-run business passionate about real estate and dedicated to healthy homes, sustainable living, and vibrant communities. Information and listings available at thealvaradogroup.com.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with John Mayer. He's the author of the book Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how personality influences our lives? And how do you think it helps us make sense of the world around us? You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org.
John, how can we use the information that you've found to better understand other people and work with their personalities?
Well, one of the most helpful ideas, I think, that run through the book that I've written is I've been looking at people who are especially adept at these kinds of skills and also looking at research studies of people who are really high in these skills. And one of the first things I've noticed is that at least that I found interesting as I was doing the book, is that very few of us are going to hit judgments at and be right all the time. In fact, I think it's pretty much impossible to be right all the time. It's kind of like forecasting the weather or thinking about movements of the stock market. We might be able to beat chance a little bit. I probably shouldn't use the stock market example. We might be able to beat chance a little bit. And that's one thing that's useful, I think, is what kind of target are we shooting for? And then a second idea is to get feedback about the people that we're making evaluations of. Let's find out if they're really the way that we think they are, because often we may find out that we've made an evaluation of someone and it may be mistaken.
Can you give us some examples or stories from the real world of personal intelligence at work?
Catherine Graham, the publisher for many years of the Washington Post, has a really lovely description in her memoir of taking over the the sorts of issues that she went through when she took over the newspaper. And she was very, very insightful about how other people viewed her. She remarked that some people probably didn't care that she was running the paper, that other people viewed her as an intruder, and possibly an ignorant intruder into the newspaper. And so she had this very accurate, I think, sense of how other people viewed her and a very accurate sense of how she viewed other people. And I suspect that her evaluations, running a little bit above average in perceiving people, probably helped her a lot in taking over that organization organization thrive.
How did she correct her behavior then, or adjust her work performance to meet the expectations of people who were seeing her a particular way at the newspaper?
I think she was very patient. She talked to a large number. She got to know a large number of people, and she began to decide who she would be able to get along with, who regarded her with respect, and who might not be able to do that. But interestingly, even if a person might not respect her or might not like her, she didn't give up on that relationship. If she thought that person was very talented at what they did, she seemed to keep that relationship going.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us. They wanted to know if this theory of personal intelligence relates to critical thinking. Can this make us better critical thinkers, and how?
Well, I think it surely relates to critical thinking when it comes to critical thinking about people and how people and how individuals think and act. I'm very interested in how it might relate to critical thinking as regards literatures and characters in literature, because I think there are some writers who are very adept at presenting us with very complete characters, and I imagine that those writers have a lot of this personal intelligence in the work that they do.
We were talking just a moment ago about judging people and categorizing people and maybe jumping to incorrect conclusions about people and challenging our own judgments. But if we were to look at the evolutionary history of our species, were there evolutionary benefits to judging, and how do we teach ourselves out of that?
A lot of evolutionary psychologists believe that one of the reasons that human beings were able to adapt to an early social environment and change their group structure was because, whereas most primates are limited to groups of about 30 in size, where they can groom one another every day, human beings developed the capacity to talk about one another. So they didn't have to see everybody every day in the group in order to talk about what they were doing and what was going on. And that allowed the groups to enlarge in size and allowed the social complexity of our species to increase. Now, you jump into a really great question how can we teach ourselves not to judge? Of course, we are taught from childhood to try to not judge other people. And one of the tricky things about personal intelligence, and one of the things I discussed in the beginning of the book, is my own struggle with that. Because as a personality psychologist, I have learned to judge and evaluate other people. That's part of my professional life. But is that a right thing? Is it a good thing, or is it a bad thing? I suspect that it's an inevitable thing, that in fact we have evolved to judge and evaluate one another. That's one way we survive, and one way our ancestors survived. So the question for me is not so much how do we stop ourselves from judging, but more, given that we can't stop ourselves from judging, how can we judge well rather than judge poorly? How can we judge fairly?
So in the workplace, something we hear very often and in other scenarios is to suspend judgment and not to judge at all in other scenarios. So are you saying that's basically impossible? We're hardwired to judge no matter what, so we should just probably get on board with figuring out how to judge better.
That's well put. Yes, I think we can't help but judge, and we can't help but have reactions to people. On the other hand, that a suggestion to suspend judgment, that does make sense if what we mean is to have that reaction, maybe even make that judgment to ourselves, but then to wait and see, you know, and realize that, you know, a lot of the judgments we make during the day about people are not going to be right. So maybe I do want to check what I'm thinking. I do want to make sure that what I'm thinking is really has some accuracy to it. And then even if it does, wonder whether there's some use to expressing it or whether it's just best kept to oneself.
And are there merits to receiving judgment about ourselves? You refer to this idea of hot information in the book.
Yes. Yeah, and that's something else I struggle with because, you know, I'm judged all the time too. And if I'm judged negatively, I don't like it. And so what do we do about an intelligence which says that we're supposed to judge one another well and we're supposed to judge one another accurately when, in fact, we don't like being, you know, judged? I don't like being judged. And I think this is one of the really fascinating things about personal intelligence, one of the fascinating paradoxes, because to learn about personality and to learn about anticipating other people and what they do and the different kinds of personalities, we have to talk about them. And most of us do talk about personalities a great deal if we're interested in those sorts of things, on the one hand. On the other hand, we don't like it when other people do it to us. So how good can we get at receiving information? And that's something I don't know. I'm still thinking about that.
Well, when I think about your book and other books like it, where we, you know, embark on these areas of self-exploration, we develop a certain vocabulary and a certain self-awareness, and then we want to apply it to our daily lives. But we find that other people that we know may not have read your book and may not have the same self-awareness or even propensity to develop ourselves into better people. How do you recommend that we go about, you know, trying to improve our relationships with other people who may not share the same values?
Well, there's a psychological quality which is very similar, which is related to personal intelligence, which is called psychological mindedness, and it's an interest. It's sort of the interest and curiosity that people have toward personality. And one of the first things I do, because of course I'm fairly high in psychological mindedness, I'm really interested in how people think and what people are doing and why they're doing it. One of the first things I try to gauge about someone when I'm meeting them, if I'm going to know them for a while, is are they psychologically minded or not? And I've learned over the years to have a lot of respect for people who are not psychologically minded. There are lots of really useful and important things that people know. And, you know, half the population is lower than average in psychological mindedness. That is to say, they're less interested in people than the other half of the population. And that's just fine. So I guess one of the things is to recognize whether somebody has interests in this area and kind of respect that. Because part of personal intelligence is understanding that we may look alike, but we're widely diverse inside.
So when you come across someone who's not, as you put it, psychologically minded, can you still do your personal intelligence judo with them, or do you just kind of lay off and figure that it just has to unfold the way it's going to unfold?
Yeah, I usually don't talk about personality with people who are not psychologically minded unless they ask me about it. I just have fun with them in some other way. Let their interests lead the conversation.
So it's almost being about aware of what personality type they have and then adapting to it.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, how can we use personal intelligence to improve our professional and personal relationships without, you know, getting a PhD?
I think that looking at some of the stories of people who are high in personal intelligence is helpful. I'm tentatively advocating that we have little courses or seminars in personality for people who are interested. So you don't have to get a PhD in it, but you can get some of the basics, about it. Because I think that some people are interested in that, and there's a lot of information out about personality on the web. And some of it's reputable, and some of it's probably a little bit not quite as accurate as it might be. So it would be nice for people in the field to have some kind of basics, you know, basics of personality that they might teach. I think that may be a little bit off in the future. Although for our children who are in school, there are a number of social and emotional learning programs that do touch on personality and self-control.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about personal intelligence.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John Mayer is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire, and his new book is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives.